None.
Okay. Thank you for the update, Kempster.
I'm ill. My reflexes are weaker.
Is your cat trying to turn off your computer again?
No, just let's move on.
Okay, hi everybody. Welcome to the Spodcast. I'm Josh, and I am a sick person. Still, actually, because I was sick last week. Joining me is another sick person in the body of Kempster.
Hello, I'm ill.
And also a not sick person by the name of Alex.
I'm okay.
Yeah, so it's, I guess this is like the holiday colds going around at this point. I've just been like feeling awful for the past 2 weeks.
It's the season for him.
Yeah. The worst part is I got the flu vaccine this year. And I'm still getting these horrible colds, so...
The flu doesn't protect you from colds,
you got it too early in the season.
Yeah.
You have last year's strain.
I only got it, like, 3 or 4 weeks ago.
Yeah, that's too early.
Anyway, let's move on to a topic of discussion that is probably more interesting than, horrible pain. Alex, you went on an excursion to Orlando.
Yeah. Everyone really likes it when I go there, because they say it's my city. That's the joke.
I can't imagine why that is.
Yeah. And the funny thing this time is that I was actually in a row on the airplane with all Orlandos that weren't related to me, including someone named Alexandra Orlando. And I got her boarding pass, and everyone was very confused, and they asked me if I was with 4 other people, and I said no. And I didn't understand why until I checked out the entire row. And
that's
we did the
weird.
Classic. It was very weird. And then the stewardess came to the back of the plane and was like, oh, who is Alexandra Orlando? And then we did the like classic, like, oh, that is me, like at the same time. Yeah, so that was interesting and very unlikely to ever happen again.
I don't know. There can't be... I mean, I guess Alexander Orlando isn't a very common name combination, but it doesn't seem like so out of the ordinary that you never meet someone named that.
But beyond the say next to them on the plane?
Yeah, that's true.
Anyway, so that's not really the... you want to develop this idea more?
Well... I just googled Alexandra Orlando and the first hit is a Canadian gymnast, which is probably neither you nor the other Canadian Alexandra Orlando.
That's
so
correct. Yes, she's from Toronto, so she lives super close to me.
It's apparently a very popular name in Canada.
Yeah, there are at least 3 of them.
It's funny because like she's Italian background too, and when she was in the Olympics representing Canada, my great-grandmother had called my grandmother and was very confused.
Aww.
Asking if I was in the Olympics. And she's like, no.
Is Alexandra like the Italian version of
no,
the name?
No, that would be Alessandra with the S's.
Ah.
But I don't have like a formal Italian first name.
Yeah. What about you, Chris? Ever run into any Chris Franklins?
Yeah, I've complained about this on the show before. The guy with my name that is the first Google result is a Canadian... is an Australian a parody songwriter who's known for one frickin' song, and it's a parody of the Meredith Brooks song Bitch, and he turned it into the Australian version Bloke, and I hate him forever, and it makes me angry.
I see that.
So,
and he's got a mullet and everything?
Yes.
I can't decide worse, being someone super prolific so you get buried, or you get, like, messed up with some guy who's barely known and he's stealing your spot.
Like, the next hit after that is a meteorologist from New Orleans, and I'm like, okay, I can take that. Like, a local TV news weatherman, that's not so bad. But the guy who's a one-hit wonder known for a parody of a 90s one-hit wonder, like, how are you a one-hit wonder parody of a one-hit wonder? I don't know, it bothers me. Sorry, I have strong opinions on this. Josh shouldn't have asked about it.
It bothers me too, actually.
Well, fortunately, when you Google Josh Veal, I am basically the entirety of the results. There are apparently other Josh Veals in the world, but I guess I'm the most famous one.
Spoiler warning, Patreon, a LinkedIn profile, and then The Escapist.
That LinkedIn profile is not me.
No, that is not you. Oh my God. No, that's a real not you, Josh Veal.
Sales executive customer engagement solutions.
The best is LinkedIn tells you when you click on someone's profiles, now he's going to have a visit from my account for some reason, and he's going to kind of wonder why that is. Anyway.
So how was Orlando?
It was good. The weather was very nice. We went the weekend before American Thanksgiving, so it was like pretty quiet. And I did both the Universal parks. I've never been since they've done the Harry Potter stuff, so it was really exciting to see all that and what they've added to the parks and changed. Yeah, it was good. It was a lot. I've done Universal before, but only like once many years ago, and I was actually on the show Slime Time Live, which is the show that they have there, and I won. Yeah. And I wasn't allowed to, we weren't allowed to put my mailing address for the prize because we're in Canada. They wouldn't ship the prize to Canada. So we had originally our relatives from New York, their address. And then they never ended up getting the prize. And they were rollerblades. And I was sad.
Aww.
So
that was a long time
ago. Contact number?
They don't have Slime Time Live anymore.
No, that's all Blue Man Group and creepy abandoned buildings now.
Yes, I've noticed. And they added one of the best rides, in my opinion, that they added is that rock and roller coaster.
Oh, yeah.
You pick your own song.
Rip Ride Rocket, I think.
Yeah, that was really good. Everything else is basically, at this point, a 3D motion ride. And by the end of it, I was getting a little sick of it. I was getting sick of the same sort of like 3D thing over and over again. Mind you, I did two parks in one day, so maybe that's why. But I was the Harry Potter stuff was cool, and the new 3D rides were cool, the King Kong one. But after a while, I don't know, it made my eyes hurt, and I just kind of wanted to get on a roller coaster.
Yeah, that's always kind of been the criticism of Universal's. It's really motion simulator heavy, and that is kind of undeniable at this point, especially since they're tearing down roller coasters to build more Harry Potter crap.
Yes, I had thought that they were going to rebrand Dueling Dragons as a Harry Potter roller coaster, and what
they did.
They did is they just have a pit there where it used to be, and they have a kiddie roller coaster somewhere else.
Well, for about 10 years it was there. Like, they had Dueling Dragons rethemed as the Triwizard Tournament Dragon Challenge or whatever.
Oh, really?
And you could see the little, the Ron's dad's car or whatever that they steal in that movie, and it sits there and goes beep, 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 and honks at you as you walk by, and there you go into a big tent, and you can see the Triwizard Cup or whatever, and a bunch of dragon eggs, and then you eventually get on the roller coaster, and it's just the same old roller coaster it was before, but, like, they tried to kind of theme it up, but it never really, like, felt Harry Pottery because it was never meant to be Harry Potter. So they are tearing it down and are building a new Harry Potter attraction.
Interesting. See, I never got to see any of that. That's a little disappointing because I thought that was a pretty cool roller coaster.
It wasn't bad. I like it better than Rip Ride Rocket because Rip Ride Rocket's big attraction is both the music and the like vertical climb. As a roller coaster, it's not that great, but that ascent is terrifying because it's not just vertical, the seats are reclined a little bit, so you're actually a little bit more than 90 degrees. It freaked me out.
Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah, that was really a cool feeling. And it wasn't long to get on, so I was happy with that. But yeah, I had a lot of thoughts and feels about the Harry Potter stuff because it seems to be one of the only like fully realized immersive areas in Universal where they've actually gone and took a lot of care into the detail of the structures and the employees that work there and their kind of personality. And they really have a theme going that was really cool to see. It almost felt like I was in a different park.
Oh yeah, totally. I think the first place that Universal sort of started upping their game theme wise. Universal proper still struggles with that, but Islands of Adventure I think is slowly coming around to some of that stuff. But yeah, Harry Potter blows everything else there kind of out of the water theming. Did you get a wand?
I didn't. I went into Ollivander's and watched a little girl try and get her wand. And that was really cute. But the wands were $40 American, and I was like, oh, that's a lot. But I did get one of the sweaters. Bucks.
Well, it comes with a little RFID thing so that you could use it in all the magic
in
the parks.
Oh, okay, yeah.
I was watching children. I was doing like a secondhand experience of that. I watched the children do it.
Living vicariously.
Yes. But yeah, I got one of the sweaters. I'm very Ravenclaw, so I was happy to get some swag. And the sweater itself is just nice, so. I didn't want the robe, because I'm like, where else am I going to wear this robe? And it was $113. I was very curious about the pricing of everything. But it was actually cheaper than what I thought it was going to be. But yeah, I was like, I'm not going to wear this robe for anything, but the sweater you can wear it anywhere.
Well, probably not in Florida.
No, but you know, it's cold here, so.
You didn't do the Jimmy Fallon ride, did you?
I didn't. I saw it, and it was kind of at the end of the day, and I was just like, you know what? I couldn't give a shit about Jimmy Fallon.
That's probably
Jimmy
the right
Fallon
call.
Ride.
Yeah, Jimmy like, Fallon's have you, what is that like?
It's basically a 3D motion simulator. Surprise. Where you ride through New York and run bumbling into a lot of different skits from his show, like the ragtime singy people and the panda bear and other skits that I presume make sense if you watch the Tonight Show with him. And then it gets weird real fast where eventually you end up going to the moon and racing on the moon, and then you come back to New York and that's the end of the ride.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever seen the show, so I wouldn't have understood any of that.
You're not missing that much.
It is a weird attempt to reach out to more family-friendly fare. From Universal. It is a bizarre property, I guess I'll put it that way. I know it's synergistic because Universal also owns, you know, Comcast owns NBC Universal, so they're like tied, but it's still weird.
It sounds like someone saw Star Trek The Experience and thought, let's do that, but with Jimmy Fallon's show.
I found a lot of the rides there were pretty scary. Like, when I did the King Kong ride, that was my first time, and I got scared by the guy that jumped out and scared me in the line. He popped out and he tried to touch me, and I got so scared. And then it was just like, so that was pretty, and like the it's kind of violent, because they show King Kong like ripping the T-Rex jaw, pulling the jaw, and then just shooting shit and blood everywhere, and I was like, oh, okay. Like, if I was a kid, I'd be pretty scared.
Scare actors in the lines is a controversial topic, apparently, among theme park fans. So that's that's an ongoing debate. Well, some people are just like, look, I just want to be in the line. I just want to wait and check my phone and not worry about being scared. And other people are like, oh my god, it's awesome. It's like a mini haunted house while you're waiting in line, so you have something to do. And it's just a very controversial topic.
I can see why people would be annoyed by that.
Yeah, but it's still cool.
I liked it. I felt like I was at... I thought of you, actually, Chris, because I'm like, oh, I'm at a Halloween haunt at Universal.
Yay!
Is Universal the one that keeps wanting to try to spray you with various liquids?
Every ride had a water spray.
I mean, not every ride, but there's a fair number of them.
More than in Disney World.
Yes.
Like percentage-wise, yeah.
I can't think of any in Disney World aside from like the water rides that actually do that, like the log ride or whatever.
I'm trying to think if there's one in Disney World.
They
Because
have
I
one
can
of
think
the
of them.
3D rides.
They use like scents and stuff. I mean, when you go over in Soarin', they spray that orange scented stuff. I can't think of any. Oh, I do. I have one. I have one. The Muppet 3D Vision. Muppet Vision 3D. With the stupid CGI 3D monster animated cartoon clown thing, tries to do a traditional cartoon joke with the flower petal and sprays water on the audience and it all rains down on the people. There's one. But that's like one out of the entire four theme parks worth of rides at or at Disney. So, yeah, Universal does it a lot.
For me, it was just a matter of like, by the end of it, I just felt like I was getting REM, like from all the 3D and not knowing necessarily where to look. That was like a big thing on the King Kong ride because it's like double-sided 3D. So I'm like, my head's going around all over the place. Plus, I'm on a roller coaster. Plus, I got all this 3D. And by the end of it, I was like, I'm actually not feeling well. And I'm like good with theme parks all the time. Like I go on as scary stuff as I can find. But it's an endurance run, that's for sure, if you're doing a lot of 3D rides at once.
I don't like the trend that Universal's been doing of bringing those what would you call them, the tram rides over to the Florida parks, because that's what that is, right? Like, and that's why the King Kong ride kind of bothers me a little bit, because it's a really, really expensive wrapper for what was just part of the tram ride in California, and not only part of the tram ride, a fairly quickie replacement part of the tram ride. So I know entirely too much about theme parks, but at some point in the early to mid 2000s or late 2000s, the King Kong ride, the King Kong portion of the tram in Hollywood burned down. And everyone was like, oh no, King Kong burned down, it's sad. So what they did is at the time Peter Jackson had recently finished up his King Kong, so he and his team made a kind of a 3D adventure thing for the tram to just sort of sit in, and you could like see King Kong fight some T-Rexes, and that's why the whole CGI part is very much in the style of the Peter Jackson movie. And all they did was basically port that part of the ride over to Islands of Adventure, and then wrap that whole tram ride with like the animatronic King Kong and the intro sequence. Like that stuff wasn't there in the original, but the rest of it was. And I don't know, it just there's something about it that feels slightly cheap. Like it's the original ride plus some DLC that you're getting for like, $40 2 years after release. I don't know. That's a terrible comparison. I'm tired and sick.
That's interesting, and now it kind of makes sense actually, now that I think about how the ride was laid out.
Yeah, because you kind of get that one. The first area is like, let's tell the people on the left to have something to look at. And then the second area is, let's give everybody on the right something to look at. And then you get the main arena where it's just you don't even know where to look because it's all encompassing and around you. And then there's King Kong's animatronic, but only people on the right get to see that. Which is kind of a bummer because it's a cool animatronic.
Oh, it was very good. Especially when you have your 3D glasses on, you're like, is this 3D or is this real life? And then you take the glasses off and you're like, it's real. That ride reminded me of the tunnel ride in Willy Wonka. That's what that reminded me of.
I could see that.
Now that I think about it, does Universal Studios own Willy Wonka?
I believe that's WB.
Oh. Well, that's like CBS and didn't they merge with CBS at some point?
Distributed by Paramount. I was wrong.
Yeah, so Paramount is the movies and CBS is the TV side probably.
Yeah.
If only Paramount
Because they did
Canada's
that
Wonderland
weird
stayed
split.
Paramount Canada's Wonderland, then we might have got a Willy Wonka ride. Now it's just Wonderland.
So did Paramount pull out of all of its like dealings with like I don't know who else they were in bed with. I think it was like the King's people, like King's Island and King's Dominion. Because I know for a while there was like Nickelodeon Studios at Paramount and other Viacom properties.
Yeah, Wonderland had what the Nickelodeon section and just the regular Paramount section. And they just pulled out of everything. At least from Wonderland. I don't know about the other ones.
Wah-wah.
But everyone still calls it by the movie names because it was around for so long. But it was, most of the rides were really shitty. Like, there was basically no theming.
I know Six Flags had a deal with WB for a while because they had, and I think they still do, because they had, like, yeah. Tweety Bird and they had the Batman ride.
Yeah, that's right. And Superman.
Yep. But they're just roller coasters, and it always bothered me because they have no, other than the coloring of the track, it's not really a themed ride, and that always just irked the crap out of me.
Well, the Superman roller coaster was the fastest one they had for a while anyway.
But you just go straight and then up. Like, that's it.
That's the parabolic arc of Superman.
We are on
the
downward
part of
that arc. If
you turn it upside down, it's the parabolic arc of the Zack Snyder movies.
Has anyone seen Justice League?
Yes.
Uh-oh.
I have avoided it.
But Coco's out.
I saw Justice League before Coco was out. Also, this Superman ride is not the one I remember.
There's different ones, I think. There's one in Darien Lake.
I just remember the one that was, like, where you went straight and then went up, and then it just sort of hanged there and then let you back down.
Yeah, that's what I remember.
That's Top Thrill Dragster.
How do you know all these roller coasters? That's crazy.
Because I'm also, like, a theme park person.
That is awesome. I mean, I don't know coasters at all. Like, I remember... Okay, Superman Escape from Krypton is apparently what it was called. And I don't know if it's still up.
There seems to be, like, five different kinds of Superman roller coasters.
WB is licensing this out like crazy. Anyway, as Justice League's not very good. Does what? Sorry.
I'm trying to think. Like, Justice League isn't Warner Brothers, though. Like, the movies aren't.
Yeah. No. Warner Brothers bought DC, like, in the 80s. Warner Brothers was responsible for, like, the Keaton Batman movies.
Thank you, Warner Brothers.
I don't know
Brothers.
Why I'm thinking that they were someone else.
Apparently, there's a Justice League ride at Six Flags, too. It's a laser car ride.
What is a laser car ride?
Where you shoot the lasers.
Oh. At the target.
Yeah, it's like the Men in Black or the Buzz Lightyear.
Right.
Speaking of which, it's really weird to go on Men in Black because it features fun Will Smith instead of Scientology Will Smith. And then you're like, oh man, like, they're still holding on to this one.
Yeah, that's weird.
It made me slightly uncomfortable.
I mean, really what makes me uncomfortable is going back to the kid zone that's about to become Nintendo Land, because holy crap, you want to talk about some things that need to be torn down and are a product of their own time. Holy crap.
Oh, the section, the Dr. Seuss section?
With the Fievel Goes West Playland, where I'm a 33-year-old adult and Fievel was a thing when I was a kid.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Did you know they still have Doc Brown and the DeLorean just off to the side
and the train.
Near the Simpsons area.
Yeah, like the first Fievel movie was the 80s. Like,
they
all
still
that
have
stuff them? Is like late 80s stuff.
Look, the theme park was built in the late 80s, early 90s. It's a weird relic of its time.
Do they have Space Jam?
I wish.
No.
They still have Blues Brothers there. I'm like, also, like, why?
Well,
like,
California
who does that
has
appeal
its own...
to?
California has its own weird stuff. They still have Waterworld Stunt Show, I think, and the Backdraft. Those are some 90s movies.
I actually have, I've never gone to a California Universal Studios, but I hear that Waterworld show is amazing.
It's a pretty cool show. It's just weird that, like, in 2017, the lasting cultural impact of Waterworld is that there's a water action show at Universal California. What was at the time one of the most expensive movies ever made, and that's its contribution to pop culture. Oh, I'm actually curious. Since I haven't been there since HHN, do they have the what's it called? What's the name of that TV show that hasn't been on the air for 10 years? That they the Bill and Ted Theater. Is the Bill and Ted Theater still being used by that crappy reality show?
Fear Factor Live?
Yes, that one.
Yeah, that was still there. I was like, why?
Well, that theater is going away because they're expanding more Harry Potter. They're always Harry Potter will just slowly consume everything in these parks.
It's but that's what, yeah. That's kind of strange.
It was the last Bill and Ted ever this year because they're going to get rid of that stadium, which is kind of sad. But also Bill and Ted, another late 80s, early 90s property that probably has seen better days.
I want to see a Bill and Ted crossover with John Wick.
Ooh.
I mean, they have a time machine.
Really, you know, I can't remember the name of the actor who played Bill.
Winters. Can't remember his name. First name.
Like, is he even still doing anything? Is he even still alive?
Alex Winter. Yeah, he's still alive. He doesn't do a ton of stuff.
He was in the Deep Web.
He hasn't done anything in about 4 or 5 years, but he's still alive.
The last thing listed for TV on his filmography on Wikipedia is an episode of Robot Chicken where he played Bill in 2012.
Oh. He's in Smosh the Movie from 2015.
Oh man, Smosh hasn't been a thing in forever.
Oh, he directed it.
Oh, God, please don't say that.
And Jenna Marbles is in it.
The internet is a weird place.
Oh, man. Anything else you want to mention about Universal Studios? Or
I think I'm good.
You know, Orlando in general.
I always like Orlando because it's like a crazy place, and it's kind of one of my first exposure that I can remember of being in America was being in Orlando, so that's like maybe a bad representation, but I always hold it near and dear to my heart. And there's a lot of gun places, and this guy that had a gun shirt, and the beer was really cheap, which I liked.
Yeah, that sounds like Florida. Oh, let's see, what else? We can talk about news real fast. By real fast, I mean we'll probably end up spending 30 minutes on it, but we haven't talked about news a lot on this podcast lately, but this seems to kind of warrant it. Plus, we have a man on the inside who's actually played it. Of course, I'm talking about Battlefront 2.
Yay!
Chris is our Battlefront 2 mole.
I like how just The act of buying and purchasing and playing this game is some sort of act of subterfuge at this point.
I mean, you've been playing it. How many other people are actually playing it?
The servers are full, and matchmaking doesn't take that long. I mean, it's a when it comes to hurting EA, I imagine it's going to be a matter of degrees. I don't think it's going to be a colossal Battleborn style no one ever bought it bomb. I think it's going to be more, instead of selling 10-15 million copies, it's going to be like a 3 to 5.
It's certainly not a Lawbreakers.
God, those are some tragic stories. Battleborn, Lawbreakers. Yeah. Like just absolutely tragic.
Like did, I don't even want to make Lawbreakers fun of it. Literally only sell a few thousand copies.
I believe so. Again, I'm the man on the inside there. I bought a copy. I'm terrible.
Like, that game is we should really do like a stream of you trying to play Lawbreakers and getting matched against people, like, and then like play some game from like the early 2000s, like go play Quake 3 Arena and see if you can get matched with people. Compare the two. Yeah, so to give some background, in case you haven't heard, and man, did this blow up. About a week before Battlefront 2 launched, some people did some number crunching with the amount of credits that it took to unlock a hero, which I believe was like 60,000, and the amount of credits that you got per match, which turned out to be like 250, 500 credits or something like that, and basically calculated that like it would take about like 40 actual hours to unlock one hero, like to be able to play as Luke Skywalker or Darth Vader. And that's like just to have the option of playing it in multiplayer, not like you just get to play as them now. You know, it's just to be able to use it when you have the option to, maybe, provided that nobody else has taken up the limited like special hero slots, as I understand it. And there was a great big outrage over this. And then I think CNN did a story about the Belgian government looking at loot boxes and whether or not they count as gambling. And shortly after that story, and like mere hours before launch, first they announced that they were going to cut down the unlock prices by like 75%. So I think like the 60,000 credits it took to unlock a hero turned into 15,000. And then not long after that, as these this negative press continued to pile on, they announced like 3 hours before the game came out that all the microtransactions were being shut down, at least temporarily. They were taking out all the stuff that you can pay for DLC wise, microtransactions wise. So like you can't buy credits anymore. You can't do any kind of stuff that involves actually paying money to get to unlock things in the game. And you kind of wonder just like what was happening at EA that week where, you go to like, oh shit, we've tripped the regulatory landmine here, and now like, oh, by the way, the Belgian government is saying like, hey, this is gambling. What are you guys doing? Like, you have to imagine that the Disney got involved and called them up and went like, "Hey, what are you doing with Star Wars?"
And then Hawaii also launched its own investigation into EA's business practices. So it's been a week for EA.
And then at some point, the Belgian Minister of Finance, Secretary of State, something like that, said that he thinks that loot boxes are gambling and should be banned in the EU. It's been a bad year for EA, actually. I mean, like, think about what happened with Mass Effect Andromeda and then this, and like.
No, I mean, EA's year this year was Battlefront 2. Like, if you ignore sports games, right? Their year was Battlefront 2, Mass Effect Andromeda, Need for Speed Payback, which also was getting slammed for its loot box system that is terrible, and I've also played that, and it's also awful. And that's it. And then some Battlefield expansions. That was their year. Sports games aside, and I guess The Sims 4 on the PS4. But in terms of their major console launches that are not sports games, they've had like three, and none of them have been well received.
My question with all this is always like, why are people getting up in arms now with loot box systems when we've had them for years? Is it the outcry of the fans that sparked the conversation, or have we just seen like an evolution into loot box systems being more predatory or more like costly for people? I don't know. And I think it's a thing where you have to pick and choose about what you're gonna criticize, because Overwatch has been getting a lot of flack for over like loot boxes, but like that's hardly the worst of it, in my opinion.
I think it's a combination of things. I think part of it is that they Shadow of Mordor kind of primed the pump for this by being another single player game that the entire end game was driven by, you know, you could grind your orcs up to level 50 in order to take over all the castles or whatever to get the true end of Shadow of Mordor, or Shadow of War rather, or you could spend some money on loot boxes and maybe take a shortcut, and then the end game isn't another 20 hours, it's another 5 hours. And I think that outrage sort of primed the pump for people to be angry. And then on top of that, this particular situation just had every red flag you could throw at it in terms of, like, lazy internet outrage, I guess. Because, like, A, it happened again, because, again, we just got mad at Shadow of War, and people are already primed to be angry about it. B, it's an EA game, and people irrationally hate EA. And I don't defend EA, but I do think people have an irrational hatred of that company. And I say this as somebody who like does not like a lot of their business practices, but like people get voted most evil company in the world like 2 years in a row against things like Monsanto and stuff. Like it's just ridiculous. You know, Dow Chemical is literally responsible for murders and deaths, and they're like, no, but EA charged me for some DLC. It's whatever. Point being, EA doesn't make it better. Star Wars, as a license, makes this bad. Because now, it's not just that, like, oh, to get the top tier guy, you gotta grind or you gotta pay for it. It's, you're not giving me Darth Vader and Luke Skywalker. I want my Darth Vader and Luke Skywalker. That's why I play Star Wars games. Why are you denying me my Darth Vader and Luke Skywalker? And so, like, I think the combination of all of that is what resulted in this being this, like, nexus of anger and hatred towards this one specific game. Also, taking you back, Battlefront 1... was criticized pretty heavily for being an affront to consumers or whatever angry consumer thing there is, because Battlefront 1 was argued to be a not complete game. There was no single player in the original Battlefront, and it shipped with something like 10 maps, which Battlefield style were all broken down into smaller versions of themselves, so that was really closer to like, I don't know the exact number, but it was probably closer to like, you know, 16 or 25 maps, because you could break, you know, there's the big desert level, the medium desert level, and the small desert level. But people just said it shipped with like 6 maps, and they all got angry at it and said it wasn't a complete game. And then EA was also launching their, you know, what was it, the season packs at the same time. So everyone argued it was really a $90 game that you were being asked to pay $60 for a demo. So again, the franchise is something that has a lot of baggage associated with it. So I think for all of those reasons, when this came out, that you're going to have to grind for 80 hours or pay some money to get to Darth Vader faster, that's really what would set people off.
I think additionally, we've been kind of seeing this fermenting outrage over loot boxes, like, that's been going from one game to the next. You know, like Overwatch had a lot of criticism about its loot box system to the point where they actually changed it and made it less likely to give you duplicates and increase the price or increase the value of getting duplicates in terms of coins to make it a little bit less. Yeah.
It's all cosmetics. Like, it's insane.
Like, I think they're, you know, with the way that they do the seasonal skins, where you have, like, kind of a limited, like, 3-week time window to get these, like, seasonal skins, and they're all usually the most expensive kind, and seasonal skins are 3 times as expensive as normal version skins of the same rarity, that, like, I can see why people would get really upset buying like 50 loot boxes and only getting like 2 or 3 of the big seasonal skins and a whole bunch of duplicates. Like, that would piss me off.
I don't know. I've just never felt the need to buy loot boxes. Like, cause it's just cosmetics. And like, to me, if you're going to, like, I'm glad they changed it and whatever, but like, I've never felt the need to be angry or like pick on that game in particular. Even, like, TF2, I would argue, had, like, a worse system than Overwatch, because there TF2 you have actual weapons.
TF2 system is openly manipulative and bad. Like, Overwatch, yeah. I think you can argue, like, you can take a philosophical stance of, like Josh was saying, if you really want to be able to just buy the thing you want and you don't like that there's this little loot game attached to it, I think it's fair to be a little judgmental of that. Like, look, all I want is my Scrooge McCree skin, and I spent $100, and all I got was every other skin but that one, and the event ended, and now I don't have enough money to go back and buy it or whatever. There's room to be critical of it, but it's got all the same criticisms of, like, you know, a collectible card game or any other thing, blind box vinyl figures, loot, monthly loot boxes where you don't know what you're going to get. It's got all the sort of problems associated with that, in terms of paying for something that you don't know whether it's going to be worth it for you. But that's a different thing entirely than intentionally designing systems from the ground up specifically to exploit players in terms of making trade-offs between whether it's worth their time or worth their money to make progress towards a specific thing, which is definitely what EA was doing here. And what shocks me is that it sounds like for a company as big as EA, they clearly did like no market testing of this mechanic whatsoever. They did not get a consultation from free-to-play experts. They did not get any sort of like market research in terms of how people would respond. They were just openly saying, like, hey, come play our beta test for us, give us free beta testing. And when players were playing the sort of, you know, the 3 days of early access, they started freaking out about the amount of time it would take to get to that content, and rightly being kind of upset that it really does seem designed to basically try to get you to give them money. And then EA's PR bumbled every step of the way after that.
Yeah, you really do have to wonder what they were thinking in terms of how they thought this would all go down. But like, I agree with you that like the Overwatch stuff is kind of fundamentally different. But like, there was a controversy there, and then you had like the CS:GO stuff, which was actually way worse, because that's actually worth, like, you can assign a monetary value to CS:GO skins because you can sell them on the Steam market. In a sense, that actually is gambling by the traditional definition.
No, Valve stuff is in general way worse than what Blizzard is doing by like orders of magnitude.
And then you had the Shadow of War stuff, and now you had this, and like you figure like there was only so many times that a big outrage like this could happen before regulators got involved, and like, I don't think it just so happened to be this one by chance, but it had that history there. Whereas, like, if this was the first big controversy over loot boxes, I don't know if you know, the Belgian government would start looking into this, or the state of Hawaii. But because there was that history, and because it's Star Wars and is so visible, and is Disney, and, you know, Disney is very conscious about their image, you know, this is kind of the perfect storm that got regulators involved and caused all this to happen, I think. Because, like, I think that's the real, like, the real tipping point of this controversy that made EA go, oh shit, was, you know, news stories about how the Belgian government is investigating Star Wars for gambling.
I mean, that happened after the game came out, right? I mean, that was after they had already removed all the...
No, that predicated the removal of the microtransactions, I'm pretty sure. I think it was like that news story, and then all the microtransactions suddenly went away.
I don't know. It's a crappy situation in general, because to sort of step back and look at a bigger picture thing here is like, I think there's no denying how manipulative loot boxes can be, especially bad ones. I mean, we can debate something like, you know, Overwatch, but certainly things like TF2, where...
Yeah.
There's a clear way that can be abused. It's clearly dangerous. There's items in there that, even if they're cosmetic only, can only be... Like, TF2 Unusuals can only be gotten either by spending real-world money on the store, which makes them have a real-world value, or by spending literally about $250, because there's a 1% chance that you'll get an Unusual hat, and it's $250 a key. So at $250 a key with a 1% chance, you have to spend about $250 to get an Unusual hat. That's ridiculous. That's the only way you can get that. And that $250 is an average, not an actual cost. You might be able to get it at $50. You might get it at $500. You don't know. That's TF2 is bad. I can go on a rant about how bad TF2 is. But I guess my point is, I don't know. It's a crappy situation, because last year or 2 years ago, they were being criticized for releasing what was essentially a $90 game and a $60 demo. Now they're being criticized for trying to release a game that has, you know, all these continuous monetization strategies that are just outrageously badly designed and manipulative. At what point do we step back and recognize that maybe games are now too expensive to be profitable through traditional business models? Because that's the thing that I think isn't being discussed enough. Because that's, to me, what is being the real story here, right? Like, the real story isn't EA, the big evil company, tried to do a big evil thing. It's to make this game cost so much money, they need alternative revenue streams, and every time they try one, they get told that they're being evil, conniving, manipulative, and bad. And that's probably true because they're not being honest with their audience about how much this stuff costs. But if the reality is to be profitable, to be safely profitable, this thing needs to cost $100, what does that say about where AAA development is? I mean, you look at other games that don't do this stuff, and a lot of them are struggling. You look at a lot of Bethesda's games this year, which have done between okay to not so great. And none of those games have, like, in, the loot boxes or season passes or whatever. Dishonored 2 has one pack of DLC that's standalone. Totally, you get what you pay for. What a Prey. Prey is a standalone game with no loot box system. Wolfenstein.
Yeah, or just look at every Square Enix Western release in the past 2 years.
Right,
Like
but
we make fun of Square Enix setting ridiculous sales expectations, but the reality is we don't really know the finances involved.
I mean, what was it? What studio recently closed down? Visceral. They closed down, and they were the Dead Space team, and they made Dead Space 3 three or four years ago at this point. And Dead Space 3 was famous for having that EA executive leak the fact that Dead Space 3, made on last generation's hardware, needed to sell 5 million copies to be considered solvent, just making ends meet. So that should give you some indication of where things are now, 3 or 4 years later, and an entire step and a half, given the PS Plus and Xbox One X, a step and a half above that console-wise, the demand for super high-resolution content. The number of sales has got to be that much more, and it's just super intimidating. I don't know. That's not to excuse bad business practices. It's really more to step back and wonder, like, how can this industry that refuses to have an honest conversation, publishers because they're afraid of angry backlash, and gamers because they don't really want to have the real truth. They don't want to recognize that this thing they love really should cost $100 and they've been getting it at a deep discount, sort of subsidized by, by whales and things like that. How can we have a conversation like that? And I don't have an answer for you.
Yeah, I mean, I would add developers in there because they get death threats on Twitter all the time whenever they speak out about difficulties with developing games.
Or not, given that we don't know what happened with that.
I
You
mean,
heard
that's
about
not the
that.
only time. Yeah, the Battlefront 2 developer that maybe wasn't actually a Battlefront 2 developer
Oh, I
that
remember that.
may or may not have gotten death threats. I don't know if that was the part that was in question, but
Well, it was a question whether he even worked for EA, because he sold himself as having worked for EA, but there was no evidence of it and a lot of contradictory info that never made any sense.
I kind of see it as this like self-fulfilling prophecy of well, that's not even right. It's a sort of like positive feedback loop that keeps bumping up game budgets, where you want to be you want to sell the most copies of your game, so you push the envelope. And pushing the envelope usually means getting a bigger, better engine that looks nicer and doing more cinematic, air quotes, stuff, and making it look more like a movie and hiring big name actors and getting a bigger marketing budget. And doing that forces other AAA games to do the same in order to stay competitive. But all this time, you're massively increasing the actual required budget to do that successfully, which means that you need to sell more to do it successfully. And there's at some point some kind of limit to how much this will actually increase sales. But if you don't do it, then you get slammed for looking like a last gen game or and having a marketing budget that wasn't as high so nobody heard about it or all that kind of stuff that happens to what happened to Titanfall 2.
I think we're reaching a point where that I think you're what you're saying is true, but I think it's increasingly less true with each passing year. Like, I watch those Digital Foundry comparison videos, and I can see the difference about what they're talking about maybe a third of the time, and only if I'm specifically looking at the zoomed-in pixels where they're like, on the PS4, the anti-aliasing is slightly better than the Xbox One, and I can kind of see it when they do the zoom-in, and I'm like, I guess it's more pixely on the Xbox One, whatever. I can't really just naked eye from a regular viewing distance see that difference. And I think the push for ever higher graphical fidelity matters less and less, especially in the face of how much more money you can potentially make if you do it with a much reduced team and budget. I'm thinking of like Hellblade, Senua's Sacrifice, recently achieved profitability, and I think they just only hit like 500,000 units sold, but they are now, every sale they make now is in the black. They have made their money back on that investment, and that's really, really cool. It's also a fantastic game, but it's really cool, and they did that with a team of, I don't know, something like 30, 40, 50 people, compared to the hundreds of people it takes to make a Skyrim or a Grand Theft Auto or a Battlefront.
Yeah. I don't want to like imply that I mean that like like increasing the actual graphics in the traditional sense of what graphics means of the game necessarily means like the costs increase. Like, I'm not even sure that's necessarily true, aside from the cost of like building a new engine for every game or whatever, which isn't even a cost that EA is eating right now because they built Frostbite specifically to do this. And they've been using it for all their games. But like the other stuff that goes into making a game look cinematic, like let's mocap everything. Let's hire big name voice actors, big name celebrity. Let's get Kevin Spacey and face scan Kevin Spacey's face, except not so much anymore. But 2 years ago, that was okay. You know, like stuff like that put, you know, let's make the world bigger. Let's put more stuff in it. You know, you can go to that mountain over there. I can't imagine what the open world trend has done to game budgets. You know, there are ways to avoid a lot of this, but like, you know, for your average Call of Duty or Battlefront or Battlefield kind of game, like, do you have the option to cut back on that kind of stuff?
I don't think you do necessarily, and that's an interesting point. Like, And that's where I think you're going to see some of this conflict that we're seeing with things like Battlefront, where, like, I don't think you can make a game like Battlefront and sell it for $60 and think it will be profitable with all of the content and the level of fidelity that you're offering now. Like, I don't think you could do a single-player campaign and, like, however many multiplayer maps it has with a space fighting mode and all the heroes and paying for the likenesses of all the famous actors and actresses and the high level of graphical fidelity in terms of just all the individual pebbles and rocks. I don't see how you can sell that for $60 and sell enough copies to make it a worthwhile investment against how much money you're going to have to spend making and advertising it. Because also, the ads are everywhere. I'm seeing Battlefront ads all over TV, all over the internet.
Yeah, that's what I meant about like marketing budgets, where like if X game boosted its marketing budget up so much and they're getting this much more exposure than Y game, then Y game has to boost its marketing budget to keep up.
And I think this is where Nintendo's actually doing an excellent job with I don't know a lot about Nintendo's sales numbers lately, but I'm sure they're pretty good. But shifting a lot of their focus for some titles going to mobile, right? Where, you know, Animal Crossing just came out. They have Fire Emblem now, Mario Run. I think that's it, right? That's the three they have?
I believe so. Then there's the Amiibo game. Or not Amiibo, the whatever, the Mii game. But yeah.
Oh, yes, the Miiverse thing. So I'd imagine it costs Nintendo next to nothing to develop these games. They probably have a bunch of the assets already. They just, like, and I wouldn't be surprised if it's more profitable than half their regular Switch games right now. Like, you know, I think they're striking the balance between, okay, these are our major titles where we're going to put, you know, effort, and maybe they're even recouping on mobile.
Yeah, I think Nintendo's in a unique position, too, since they own two major platforms now. I mean, the 3DS is probably on the way out, but it's not like you're seeing a significant drop in 3DS titles coming out. And it's definitely cheaper to develop for the 3DS than it is to develop like a AAA game for the Xbox One. And it's almost certainly cheaper to develop a Switch game as well. So, like, you know, we're kind of seeing that weird Nintendo strategy of bet everything on the hardware paying off. And now they've also moved into mobile space, which is, you know, definitely more profitable, it seems like, at this point.
I mean,
I think it'd be really cool to see, like, the Switch become a big platform for, like, indie games and, like, mid-budget games.
That's where it's heading, and it's pretty awesome at the moment. Like, old ports of Bethesda games and a bunch of indie titles and EA, or Nintendo First Party stuff. And it's pretty fantastic as a platform because of that.
Yeah.
I still don't know if Nintendo's really cracked the code for mobile development, though. I feel like their investors pushed them that way because they wanted to see something on the scale of an Angry Birds or a, I don't know, pick your Candy Crush Saga, pick your mobile game of choice. I'm sure these games are making money for them, but, I mean, there was that report that came out that Nintendo was not happy with the performance of Mario Run, and I know that's kind of a weird case because it's like the one of them that doesn't have microtransactions. It's just a basically a demo, and then you can pay $10 to get the whole thing. But I don't know. It's interesting to see that whether or not they're going to find their footing on mobile stuff and figure out exactly how to make that stuff lucrative for them. But I will say, having played a lot of Animal Crossing Pocket Camp or whatever, it does definitely reuse assets from the original Animal Crossing games, like, pretty much entirely. So I cannot imagine the content creation cost of that game being very much at all.
Ugh, all this talk about game budgets is making me wobbly. Campster, you've played Battlefront 2. You want to close us out by telling us about what Battlefront 2 is like in the wasteland that is what's left of the progression system?
It plays like Battlefront 2 with a couple fixes and a lot of crap. Or it plays like Battlefront 1, rather. Like, they have not fixed the shooting.
Doesn't sound great.
So I was thinking about this last night after playing it. I've been woozy and sick for the past 2 days. You can still hear it in my voice. I was up to like 2 a.m.-ish playing it on the PS4. And I don't know how to say this without sounding completely nerdy and insane. But, like, having played Dark Forces, Jedi Knight, various other non-Jedi Knight-related shooting games involving Star Wars, I get a sense of how I think the guns in that universe work, and none of the guns in this game work like that. And I think this was true in the original as well, but they are not, they're all hit scan, and that bugs the crap out of me, for one thing. Like, Star Wars blasters should not be hit scan guns. This is not Call of Duty. So I don't like the way they feel just like right off the bat. You know, looking down iron sights and firing hit scan weapons that have a preset amount of accuracy doesn't feel like every other Star Wars game I've played, where you fire a blaster and it goes pew 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 and you see the little tiny phasers fly out and only vaguely go in the direction you aimed because they're phasers or they're blaster fire, and in Star Wars blasters are inaccurate crap weapons because Star Wars. That's not the case here. And not only are they much more accurate, but also, like, I don't know. I'm trying to think of other things to complain about. So the blasters feel weird. Also feeling weird is playing as a hero. They never fix that, especially a lightsaber hero. It's basically keep hitting the button to do a insta-charge. Like, you know how in Destiny when you're playing, like, Striker or whatever, and you, or any of the characters in Destiny, when you activate your superpower in Destiny 2 and you're just really strong and you have a melee? It's like that. It's like you get to instant home in on people and do a swing strike while flying around, and you don't really have any real control over it, but it's okay because you have a huge damage reduction and you deal tons of damage. That's literally what it is playing the hero. And so there's no skill, there's no strategic use of the hero. It's not like, oh, if I go Boba Fett, I can use my jetpack to fly up there and do a thing. No, there's none of that. It's as shallow as Battlefront 1. where there's it's just you know, you're either playing a very basic first person shooter or you're playing a very basic version of you are a powered up Destiny doing his ult thing, powered up Destiny Guardian doing his ult thing, and I don't like the way it plays. The one thing they have fixed that I do like is they have gotten rid of vehicle tokens and they've gotten rid of hero tokens, so it's no longer literally walking around going, oh my god, a hero token, I can be the hero now, and taking over the hero. It's as you play the game, you get points for dying, you get points for killing, you get points for damage inflicted, you get points for objectives, and those points go into a pool that you can then invest in saying, I'm going to use all my points and be Chewbacca, or I'm going to use all my points and be Darth Vader, or whoever. I can't speak to how particularly balanced that is, because I've only done it a couple times, because it's actually a fairly sizable number of points to get to, like, the high-level characters like Darth Vader or whatever. I actually don't have Darth Vader unlocked. We were talking about that earlier. But, you know, like, Darth Maul or whoever. There's like, a 6,000 to 8,000 tier, and then, like, a 10,000 to 12,000 tier. And unlocking the 10,000 to 12,000 tier is just too much. I'd have to be better at the game and care more, and I don't. Vehicle combat is still really bad. Once again, much like I want the first person segments to feel like Dark Forces. I want the spacey stuff to feel like Rogue Leader. It doesn't feel like Rogue Leader. It just feels like an awkward, bad flight simulator. I don't know. I don't know what you're looking for in terms of criticisms. I've also played the single player, which is awkward.
It just sounds like everything that we thought watching that demonstration at
E3.
Yeah, in
like
the worst possible way.
I mean, it's if you liked Battlefront 1 and don't mind all the drama from this recent news, you'll probably enjoy this. I have been playing too many Star Wars games to really dig it. It doesn't play like Star Wars to me. And it just makes me want a story being told with this engine and this level of fidelity, but there really isn't one. Even in the single player, there's not much of a story. It makes no sense, and it makes me angry. Like, the story is one of those things you could, like, hate watch.
Well, I've got good news for you. EA recently closed the studio that was making the single player Star Wars game, so... Hey!
Now I feel like an ass for making fun of it, but it is pretty profoundly bad. I don't know. The fact that you can play Luke Skywalker in this game and Luke Skywalker at no point puts down his lightsaber is a big indicator to me of where this game's intent is, and it's frustrating.
It's like the prequel mentality skinned with the other Star Wars properties.
More or less, yeah.
I saw a video of someone playing as Luke, and she killed a whole bunch of stormtroopers, and then Luke's voice line was like, I never wanted this to happen.
Yep, that's in the single-player
campaign. A little late for that.
So, the single-player campaign is weird, because it starts, it pulls a head fake. You think you're playing as Iden Versio, I think her name is, who is an Imperial... basically special ops person who does bad things for the Empire. But then about four levels into the game, it switches up, and then you're playing as Luke Skywalker for a little bit.
Wow.
It's bizarre. And then you go back to Iden Versio, but it's like... I don't know. It wants to do the whole conflicted, interesting hero, but it doesn't know how to tell that story in a post... What's the phrase for the era in between Return of the Jedi and Force Awakens? That era of the new
Post
Old Republic.
Of the Jedi.
Yeah. Well, because basically in you by like level 2 or 3 you are on Endor trying to fight the rebels that took the shield base, and then you see the Death Star blow up in space from where you are, and you're like, oh no, how could this be? And it's your first inkling that maybe something is wrong in the Empire. And it doesn't work, because you know the Empire is evil, so these characters going like, what? The Empire? Failing? Incompetent? Evil? No! And it just... I don't know, it's so frustrating to watch that from this perspective. Also, I'm just really tired of, like, taking things that should be kid-friendly and fun and turning them all grimdark by making the bad good guys bad. Like, I don't like that we still have, both in the movies and in Injustice, a Superman that's like a fascist evil leader. And I don't like that here we have the good guys in this game start out as the Empire's evil henchmen. I don't know, it bugs me.
Well, that's disappointing. It's all disappointing. Except Orlando.
That sounds a little disappointing. I'm going to admit, Orlando's got the train. A little disappointed.
But when you go there on the airplane, you get to ride the tram in to the terminal. You get a ride.
What? The airplane?
The airplane lands at MCO.
The airplane lands on a freight train, and then you ride the freight train into Disney World.
No, there's the monorail that you ride from the terminal to the main hub in the MCO.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, it's awesome.
And it has like a little announcement from the mayor of Orlando, and he's like, just so you know, we've got other things in this city besides theme parks, even though that's what everyone's here for.
There are actually permanent residents that don't work at these theme parks. Can you believe that?
Isn't it like Bud Dyer or whatever?
That sounds right.
The only reason I remember that... Oh, this is terrible. Never mind, I'm not going to say that on the show. That's too dark. I was trying to end this on a happy note.
Thank you for that enlightening anecdote, Campster.
It would have gone too dark. We're going somewhere happy. We're going to Disney World.
Yeah, fuck Orlando, or fuck Universal Studios.
You heard it here, folks.
That's our hot take for the day.
Don't at us.
At me?
At you about how Universal sucks?
At me about anything, I'm lonely.
Aww.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.